All right, we are on commandment number 7, week 9. And the commandment is a 5-word commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery. And so what we're going to do, we're going to get right into the facts of the law and get into our first paragraph here. And this is what it says. Commandment 5 introduces us to the importance of the family as the second foundational pillar of all of human government. God puts the responsibility on the parents to live according to biblical principles and train their children to honor not only them as their God-ordained authorities, but also all adults and adults in positions of authority. It's one of these things. If you are in a store, and you'll, for any given amount of time, you'll find out whether parents are actually training their children or not by the way they respond, not only to them as parents, but to someone, another adult. I've been treated pretty bad by some little kids, and you kind of like looking to see if mom and dad's looking or not. But that's one of those things you'll recognize right away. Commandment 6 bridges these two family commandments together by reminding us that hatred is murder. And when parents don't properly teach honor, the natural result will be hatred. And according to an article in the 2000 Democrat and Chronicle newspaper, there were 29 homicides in 1999. That's obviously going back 7 years now. Eight of the 1999 slayings involved domestic disputes. Most Rochester murders these days result in simmering disputes between friends over money or personal issues. And let me just take a moment right here to read some domestic violence facts as we talk about adultery. It really deals with the family issues. And let me just read a couple of these to you. This is from the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. In 2001, there were 691,710 non-fatal incidents of violence committed by the current or former spouses, boyfriends, or girlfriends of the victims. In one study, 33% of victims of intimate partner violence, that's how they combine these relationships together, stated the offender was a spouse. So 33%, it was a spouse. 14% of all of those said the offender was a former spouse. So now you've got a total of 47%, almost half of all the domestic violence occurs between a husband and a wife or former husband-wife relationships. And I'm guessing, because I've heard from others, that these are probably some of the most exciting visits that you guys get to make, right, Steve?
Oh, yeah.
I've heard many stories. In regards to homicide, in the year 2000, 1,247 women and 440 men were killed by an intimate partner. In 1999, intimate partner homicides accounted for 32% of the murders of females and 4% of the murders of males. Now, this is for the United States of America as a whole. I'm going to read some from the state of New York. But they say this before I go there. The cost of this violence annually exceeds $5.8 billion due to direct health care expenses, lost productivity, and earnings. And so that's where our world has gone. And so this concept of adultery affecting the families, there's a lot that goes on in the families, and some of it's tied to this. Now, here's New York State. In the year 2002, 120 females were murdered by males in single-victim, single-offender homicides. For New York homicide cases in which the relationship between the victim and offender was known, 46% involved a relative or intimate partner in the year 2001. There were 67 family-related homicides in New York City in 2004. That's pretty much most of the information, but that's exactly what we're talking about as we think about this thing of the family relationship. And when we are not training people, when the family's not training the children, this is where everything goes to, domestic violence. And it's an issue that needs to be addressed. The quickest way to destroy the family unit as a foundation for government is to put division between the husband and the wife. When the husband and wife are divided, there can be no proper training of the children. It's not that there can't be training, but there's not going to be the foundation that needs to take place for children to actually learn. The relationship must be protected at all costs. Here's a quote. Adultery was not merely a violation of another man's household, the trespass upon the rights of a fellow male, threatening the security of his bloodline, but a violation of his unity with his wife, a breaking of the state of one flesh. And adultery was not of the body, but also of the heart. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, fornication. Matthew 15:19. Proverbs condemns all sexual relationships outside of the marriage relationship. Clearly then, in conclusion of this paragraph, biblical law is designed to create a familistic society, and the central social offense is to strike at the life of the family. God has to include this commandment because of not only the seriousness of it, but because of the commonality. And God knows the heart of people. And this is not something that happens mostly in New Testament to current age era. It was something that obviously happened all through the Old Testament as well. And God, knowing the heart of man, knew that this had to be a bold reminder to us to not commit adultery. Now, I know that there's some practical things we're going to get to in just a little bit, but you and I, as men, have to protect our relationship with our wives. It is something that usually, maybe it's always, it does not happen overnight. It does not happen on the spur of the moment. Normally, it's something that gradually builds because of a lack of protecting our hearts. And it's an erosion. Slowly, little by little, we make exceptions to things. And men going out on lunch, maybe they even call it business dates, business luncheons with one lady, and which I would recommend at all costs you avoid. Those are the things that start to make slow erosions at the relationship of the husband and the wife. Marriage was the first institution formed by God. It is the most important aspect of human government and requires the utmost respect and reverence. In so stating, it must be understood that marriage is a natural, normal, and expected state for mankind. Now, I add that in there because our world and our country will tell you otherwise right now. They will tell you that it is just as easy, just as good to cohabitate. I was watching just recently on the news. They were doing a little segment on someone. Is it Colleen McCulkin or something like that? That kid that was in Home Alone a long time ago. And is that what it is? And anyway, they were asking him, "Are you?" He's been with this lady for 3 or 4 years now. And the person asked him straight, "Are you going to get married?" He said, "No. Why ruin a good thing?" He said, "I'm just, in my mind, it's been going so well, why ruin it?" And really, that is the general mentality in the United States of America and in our world today. God instituted this as a natural thing. There are exceptions, we'll see that, but there are exceptions for certain people to not be married. And if they can handle that, they're different, okay? But there are people that can handle that. And if they can stay in that state, then Paul says, by all means, do that, and you can be more dedicated to the work of the ministry. So it's a normal state for mankind. God said that it is not good that a man should be alone, Genesis 2:18. Foundationally, God wants a man and a woman to be together. Paul lists a couple exceptions in the New Testament, but again, those are the exceptions. And we have Genesis 2:18 and on listed here as the text to prove that God wants marriage to be the foundation and to be a normal pattern. Letter B, marriage was instituted by God for some primary reasons. Number one, it is a picture of the relationship of God and the church. Ephesians 5:25, as Paul is going down through this, he is comparing the two, the relationship of Christ and the church, and the husband and wife, and as a matter of fact, he's talking so closely. Verse 31, he says, "For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church." So even as we're reading down through that text, and it's obviously of the husband and wife, Paul says, now wait a minute, don't get confused. I'm actually talking about Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let every one of you in so particular, every one of you in particular so love his wife, even as himself, and see the wife that she reverenced her husband. So the first thing is a picture of the relationship of God and the church. This is why it is so important for us, one of the reasons it's so important for us to protect this relationship is the picture it is of salvation. And when a relationship between a husband and a wife in the Christian realm breaks apart, it ruins the picture of Christ and the church to the unsaved world. It totally destroys that picture of faithfulness, of God having that relationship with the church and being faithful to the church. And we need to protect it from that. But the other thing it does is it ruins the picture of Christ and the church to the children. And just, you know what, we're setting them up for a pattern. I was telling our students just this last Sunday, when I was up at Word of Life for writing teams in January, I was sitting down with a guy who discipled me, Rick Garland, and we were talking about that, and he asked me how my dad was doing. And I said, well, he's doing pretty good. Number two, marriage is for the purpose of procreation. It is for the purpose of procreation. God told Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it. God's design was for a man and a woman to come together and begin a new family unit. This was the design for a sexual relationship and the bond of trust and love. This keeps the natural desire for the sexual union holy before God. 1 Corinthians 7:2. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. And so the relationship of husband and wife is the only place for what our world calls safe sex. It's the only place. There is no other exception to that. There's no place where it is safe outside of the marriage relationship. And so that is one of the three primary reasons or purposes for the marriage relationship. Number three, the marriage relationship is for partnership. Marriage solves the problem of loneliness. God made people to need others in their lives for accountability, fellowship, and encouragement. Again, back to Genesis 2:18, and the Lord God said, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him a helpmeet for him." In Ecclesiastes talks about the same thing. Proverbs 18:22, "Whosoever findeth a wife findeth a good thing and obtaineth favor of the Lord." And so it does bring favor when we get married. So it is for partnership. There's obviously some other issues or some other reasons for it, but those are the three primary. You could probably fit any other ones that you can think of under one of those three categories. Let's look at the fallout of the commandment or the fallout of this law. The consequences following or surrounding this commandment. I want to show you from biblical law perspective, when a man brought an accusation against his wife for unfaithfulness, I want you to see what Numbers 5 said that they were supposed to do. Now again, this is going to have some aspects to it that can't be repeated today because of some of the things that the priest was to do. But this is how God wanted it handled. Number one, the man detects a problem with or without evidence. For some reason, a spirit of jealousy, Numbers 5:14, comes up in him. And he be jealous of his wife, and she be defiled. Or if the spirit of jealousy come upon him, and he be jealous of his wife, and she be not defiled. So in other words, he's not sure there's an issue. He has a suspicion. I think that for the most part, ladies have this more than guys do. A lady can detect when something's wrong. A lady can detect when there's a lady that has the desire for her husband. Now, I had one situation where I was in Michigan in which I detected nothing. Sometimes we're dumb sheep, us guys, but and I'm not even saying there was something that was wrong, but we were discipling another couple, and there was nothing really but problems with this couple. I mean, we showed up one time at the in the home, and the wife was there, didn't see the husband anywhere. So we're just kind of chatting for a while, and finally I just said, "Hey, where's your husband?" And he's in the bedroom ironing. Ironing. Okay. So I went to talk to him. Well, there was a big spat that had gone on that day, and they weren't getting along. They didn't communicate real well, and he basically had told her right before we got there, "Why don't you call him and cancel? I don't want him to come tonight. I don't even want to talk to anybody." And we showed up, and she had not called, so we got to enjoy the scene for a while there that night. And but there was a lot of problems that were going on there. And at one point, as my wife was talking with this other lady in counseling and giving her encouragement, the lady said, she said, "I wish my husband was like your husband." And all of a sudden, my wife was kind of like, she got slapped. She was like, "Really?" All of a sudden, I mean, I am telling you, radar was up from that day on. And this couple was also helped out with the teenagers. And one day we were going on a little trip into town with the teens. We were taking them out to ice cream after a Sunday evening service, and we had a caravan of vehicles, and I was driving the church van, 15-passenger van, and I was obviously in the front seat. We started taking, we were getting ready to take off. My wife was in our personal vehicle in front of us, and there was room in all three of these vehicles. Well, doesn't this lady jump into the front seat of this 15-passenger van in my vehicle when other vehicles were open? Well, I'm telling you, there's all space in between. I thought nothing of this. Okay, well, we just filled up our space. Well, we got home that night. Did I get an earful? And now she wasn't blaming me, but she was. Her radar was hot, and she said, "Listen, that is not going to happen again. And I want you to know that I detect something, and I am just warning you." I said, "No problem. Nothing. There will not be any contact with this person." But the lady has a sense in that stuff. And usually the men, a little more naive, I guess you'd say, in some ways, to that. But in this situation, God says if the man has a suspicion, the spirit of jealousy, that he can, this is the process he's going to go through. So the man detects a problem. Number two, he brings his wife before the priest with the required offering. He had an offering he was supposed to bring. It's mentioned in here. Tenth part of an ephah of barley meal. He shall pour no oil upon it, nor put frankincense upon it, for it is an offering of jealousy, an offering memorial, bringing iniquity to remembrance. So there's going to be something different about this offering. Number three, the priest makes the offering with holy water in dirt from the floor of the tabernacle. We alluded to this, if you remember, when we were talking about Jesus with the woman taken in adultery in John chapter 8. And we don't know all that went on there, but remember he was kind of doodling in the sand inside of the tabernacle or the temple, and he was kind of messing around with writing stuff in the sand there. And some people, or the dirt, some people will tell you that they believe this is what it was pointing to. This is what Jesus was doing. Not that he enacted upon it, not that he was the priest, and not that he put it into a drink and went through this, but this is what it was pointing to. Again, pointing to biblical law. So the priest shall bring her near and set her before the Lord. And the priest shall take holy water in an earthen vessel, and the dust that is in the floor of the tabernacle, the priest shall take and put it into the water. Now, I imagine this is a well-known thing back in their day. I imagine if the wife was guilty, she's getting a little bit nervous at this point. She's sitting before the Lord. She's been placed before God. And this is what's going to take place. Number four, the priest will explain to the woman the process, or what the process would be. If she is guilty of adultery, her thigh will rot and her belly would swell. Now, again, how does dirt do that? I think there's something that God does here. It's more of a supernatural thing. God is going, she is now set before God, set before the Lord, and the Lord is going to give his mind on it. He's going to tell what is going on here. If nothing's going on with this lady and his suspicion is false, she's going to be fine. But if his suspicion is true, then God's going to say, I'm going to prove it to you by her thigh rotting and her belly swelling. And so he takes this offering, verse 18, and then verse 19, the priest shall charge her by an oath and say to the woman, if no man hath lain with thee, and if thou hast not gone aside to uncleanness with another instead of thy husband, be thou free from this bitter water that causeth the curse. But if thou hast gone aside to another instead of thy husband, and if be that thou be defiled, and some man hath lain with thee beside thy husband, then the priest shall charge the woman with an oath of cursing, and the priest shall say unto the woman, the Lord make thee a curse and an oath among thy people, when the Lord doth make thy thigh to rot and thy belly to swell. And so she takes the water. The woman shall say, Amen, Amen. She'll agree to this. Number five, the whole process is recorded in a book. And then the woman must drink the offering. And so she takes part in this in verse number 23. Number six, the priest takes the offering, waves it before the Lord, causing her to drink again. And at that point, we find out the truth of it. Verse 29 says, this is the law of jealousies, when a wife goeth aside to another instead of her husband and is defiled. Or when the spirit of jealousy come upon a man, and he be jealous over his wife, and the woman is set before the Lord, and this is what's going to happen. And so, in biblical law, under God's theocracy, God takes active part in bringing sin to the surface. Obviously, God brings sin to the surface in our lives today as well, but not in such a direct role as this. I can tell you that you and I know this to be true when we see someone else get in trouble. We talked about this last week. We learn lessons. And when we see that, when a woman in this day would see how God would bring the truth out, and there was no denying it at that point, that they would learn the lesson as well. Now, this process is never illustrated anywhere else in the Bible. We don't see any illustrations of this happening besides the one here in Numbers chapter 5. Joseph could have employed this in his justified suspicion of Mary. Joseph knew that she had not had relations with, that he had not had relations with her, yet she was pregnant. What better proof is there that someone has slept with someone than someone being pregnant? I mean, I there's no better way to prove that. Joseph could have implemented the process to see if she was being honest in her story of never having had sexual relationships, still claiming virginity. Yet Joseph was going to put her away privily or privately. And so the process was not enacted here. It was not implemented, but it could have been in this situation. Adultery was punishable by death in the form of capital punishment. And here are three of the illustrations given directly. Someone in a sexual relationship with a wife of another man, the wife of the man's father, Leviticus 20:11, and Leviticus 20:12, the daughter-in-law of a man. And so those are the three situations given directly and called confusion in the third situation. And so the death penalty was enacted again in this situation. Letter C. Adultery is the beginning of the destruction of the God-ordained training ground for children. The parents, being God's representative on earth, show a confusing picture of faith of the faithfulness of God. God's design for child training involved a family unit. The husband and wife teaching the children. And that's how God designed it. In Proverbs chapter 1, verse 8, my son, hear the instruction of thy father, and forsake not the law of thy mother. Repeated again in chapter 6, verse 20. And in Deuteronomy 21, verse 19, then shall his father and his mother lay hold on him. This is the process, if you remember, of the rebellious son. And the mother and the father took part in that. And so, again, just showing that the marriage relationship is a picture of God's relationship with the church, and it must be protected because of the picture. We've already discussed letter D. So letter E, the guilty party becomes the target of jealousy and revenge. This is one of, as we mentioned, one of the consequences of someone being involved in adultery. Proverbs 6:32, but whoso committeth adultery with a man lacketh understanding. He's a dummy. He that doeth it destroyeth his own soul. A wound and dishonor shall he get, and his reproach shall not be wiped away. For jealousy is the rage of a man. Therefore he will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will not regard any ransom. Neither will he rest content, though thou givest many gifts. Rage, jealousy. And God says you are putting yourself in a very bad predicament, in a bad situation when you get involved in adultery. You're stealing someone else's wife. Now we know that we're going to talk about this at the very end under practical issues, but we know this to be true of the mind. If a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. And then Jesus in the New Testament tells us that when someone thinks on a woman in his heart, thinks on a woman, he commits adultery with her already in his heart, if you're lusting after someone. And so although people may not know about that, God does, and God sees it the same. It needs to be dealt with in the same manner. Letter F, adultery leads to physical problems. Proverbs 6:27, can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes be not burned? Can one go upon hot coals and his feet be not burned? So he that goeth into his neighbor's wife, whosoever toucheth her, shall not be innocent. As a matter of fact, God says he will take vengeance on such in the New Testament book of Hebrews. The Lord is the avenger of all such, he says. 1 Corinthians 6:16, what? Know ye not that he which is joined to a harlot is one body? For two, saith he, shall be one flesh. But he that is joined unto the harlot is one spirit. Flee fornication. Every sin that a man doeth is without the body, but he that committeth fornication sinneth against his own body. And again, you can look out at it how you want, but I have a feeling that the diseases that are going around our world have a lot to do with the sin that's going around our world. The best, as we said a moment ago, safe sex is marriage. That is the safe way of being involved in a sexual union. No other way is safe. And God is the avenger of all such. Letter G, adultery leads to financial ruin. For the commandment is a lamp, and the law is a light, and the reproofs of instruction are the way of life, to keep thee from the evil woman, from the flattery of the tongue of a strange woman. Lust not after her beauty in thine heart, neither let her take thee with her eyelids, for by means of a whorish woman a man is brought to a piece of bread, and the adulteress will hunt for the precious life, brought to being a beggar. Adultery and fornication lead to shame and a bad reputation. We've already read that verse in Proverbs 6:32, and so it's an obvious consequence is shame, especially when someone is caught. Number three, the framework of the law. Any case laws that would be found under this commandment? And the first one that we want to touch on tonight is that of divorce. Now, divorce, we're going to read through some of this, and this is going to be one of those topics that has always raised questions to the severity of following exactly what is printed. Is there exceptions to these things or not? Different churches handle it differently. When I first went to our church in Michigan, there was a situation in which we had a lady that was just serving in the kitchen, but questions from people, and I don't even know who it was, came out whether or not she should be serving because she was divorced, and whether or not she should actually be allowed to serve in the kitchen. I mean, she wasn't a pastor. obviously. But should she be allowed to serve in the church? And there were some that held so tightly to some things that they, in some of their interpretation on this law, that they were not willing to even let her do that. So here we go. Letter A, divorce. The breaking or dissolving of the marriage covenant. The following provide permission for divorce, not license. Divorce is never commanded. Jesus said that God permitted divorce due to the hardness of the hearts of the people. And Matthew 19:8 says, He saith unto them, Moses, because of the hardness of your heart, suffered you to put away your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. And so God is not the author, obviously, of divorce. That's not God's desire. It's not God's plan. It was not the plan of God for marriage to ever dissolve. Number one, the permissible exceptions for divorce according to the Bible. We'll give you three of them. Number one, fornication. A sexual relationship of any kind with a person that is not a marriage partner. And here are a couple of our texts that we want to look at. Matthew 19:3. The Pharisees also came to him, tempting him, and saying unto him, Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? I mean, so here's the question comes to him, can we just leave our wives for whatever reason we want to? Is that allowable? He answered and said to them, Have you not read that which that he which made them in the beginning made them male and female, and said, For this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and the twain shall be one flesh. Wherefore, in light of what I just told you, they are no more twain but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let no man put asunder. So Jesus clearly answers his question. Can a husband leave his wife for whatever reason he thinks is valuable or viable, important to him? Jesus says no. That is not the way it is supposed to be. As a matter of fact, he goes on to say this again. They say unto him, let's read what they ask, because he's going to get to this again. Why did Moses then command to give a writing of divorcement and to put her away? So their misinterpretation. Why did Moses command this? Why did he say this is how it's going to happen? He said unto them, Moses, because of the hardness of your heart, suffer you to put your wives away. But from the beginning it was not so. And I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and there's our one that we're going to for one of these exceptions, not commanded, but permitted, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. And whoso marrieth her which is put away, doth commit adultery. And so there's Jesus' perspective on divorce. Now questions arise. Number one, so are you telling me that if the people who have remarried someone who is divorced, who are someone who was divorced, they were in a previous relationship, previous marriage, that's adultery. They're living in adultery right now. That's how it reads it. That's how it reads it. Now, is there a possibility of exceptions to that? I don't know. I read it just the way it says it there, and I at face value, I say no. How many of you, who's got some input on that? Anybody got some ideas on that? So someone comes into your little cubicle, ask the question, what are you going to say?
I don't know. I read it last week, and she said to me how I read it. It seemed pretty cut and dry to me.
So let's put it this way. A guy comes to you for counsel. He's never been married, or he has been married, but he says to you, hey, I'm really interested in this lady. She's divorced. Things didn't go real well for her in her first marriage, and we're considering getting married. I'm gonna ask her to marry me this weekend. Can you give me some counsel? What are you gonna say? I mean, obviously you have a passage here, a verse here. What are you gonna say? What's your counsel gonna be?
Yes, you do. Adultery, and weren't together anymore, then it seems that she'd be permitted to be fine. In this case here, it clarifies that the woman committed adultery and was speaking to the man, what we profess reverse that. Turn it to vice versa. And if the case is that just for some reason, and she decided that she wanted to leave, I guess the person would be not lawful for you to marry.
Okay.
I wouldn't want to be the one that helps.
Yeah, I'd say go see Pastor Mike.
I'll say go see Pastor Mike. Yeah, Dan?
How does this fall under the still being part of the Old Testament law for the death of the testator, Jesus Christ, and he's ushering in grace? I mean, here he shows grace to the adulterous woman taken supposedly in the act.
Well, right, grace and the fact that he was not the law. I mean, it was not a theocracy at the time. So, again, he supported capital punishment by saying, if you're without sin, cast the first stone. Go ahead and start the process. But at the same time, Jesus was not the law. Rome was. And so he couldn't take matters into his own hands at that point, according to human government. Obviously, he's God, but according to human government, he couldn't do that. So, I'm not sure that would be, inequality in this situation. I know this is one of those situations, just like someone comes up to you and says, "Are you telling me that my grandmother's in hell now?" Because she is. You're going to get that. You preach on hell, you preach on salvation, and you get a crowd there, and they're going to say, and they're going to come up after and say, "You're going to tell me my grandma's in hell right now?" Well, I'm not saying it's wrong to say yes. What I'm saying is it's difficult. And you have someone come to you and say, "Are you telling me I got remarried? Are you telling me that I'm living in adultery right now because I married a divorced person?" I mean, that's what we read. And at the same time, it's difficult. It's a difficult pill to swallow.
This is what I want to do. With marriage, then you both get married for the first time, but together on your first night together, your first night together with that person or anybody else, wouldn't that be living in adultery too, though? That's just how it seems to me. I think you'd be living in adultery that way, too.
Could be.
Is there any other place in the Bible that you know that speaks about divorce?
It's mostly here.
Most of that.
Yeah. So there's no... What we don't have is we don't have a repeal. We don't have a restatement. We don't have God clarifying in somewhere else where, how we talked about... some people agree and disagree on whether or not commandment number 4 is still viable for today. Should we still observe the Sabbath, even if it is Sunday to us? Should we still have the same respect for that day? And some people obviously would say yes to an extreme. Some people say no. We live in freedom. But we would go to that because it's there's some things that we would say are repealed because of statements in the New Testament. We don't have that in regards to divorce. We don't have a fresh statement. Now, I have to say the only, and this gets again touchy, I have listed in here under number 3, God, the example of God with the adulterous nation of Israel. It says in verse number 8, he said, "When for all the causes whereby backsliding Israel committed adultery," we're talking about spiritual, but he says, "I had put her away and given her a bill of divorce." And so God divorced Israel, his bride. Will that be changed? Well, he does come back to his bride at some point in the future. Now, again, that's murky. I'm not sure how that would translate into what we're talking about.
It almost
at the very least, Matthew 5:31 is repudiating a light attitude towards marriage and divorcement. Maybe we can't always figure out what the Bible is saying exactly to us, but we can determine what it certainly is not saying. And the sense or the feeling you get from the verse is that, at the very least, I'm not saying this is going to sit down and draw a clean line, but at the very least, Jesus is warning this right attitude. Well, the way Moses wrote it in the Old Testament was, if you find something unclean in her, hand her a bill of divorce and send her out of your house. And he says that God wrote that because of the hardness of your hearts. He says, but really, what's going on there is that it's a very powerful thing that's going on. And he's just trying to, if you read the rest of the verses all the way around that passage, Jesus is teaching us spiritual truth. And I think he's trying to make us look at, there's more going on, the theme of that chapter is there's more going on than what we see at the surface. Don't just think that you can just wipe your hands clean of something by hanging someone a bill of divorcement and send them out of your house. He's saying, look deeper and think hard about the consequences.
Okay. So maybe an overall reminder. But again, right. And there's obviously in the statement of Matthew 5:31 very clearly, saving for the cause of fornication. And here's the hard pill to swallow too, by the way. Causeth her to commit adultery. That's a hard pill to swallow. The husband decides to divorce and causes her to commit adultery. And that's a hard one to explain, hard one to swallow, at least in her innocence, if she is, why that would be. And then whosoever shall marry her that is divorced committeth adultery. So in the case of counseling, again, that's a difficult thing. The lady's husband leaves her for something other than fornication. He is in divorces her. He is causing her to commit adultery. And then, in the innocence, the man who decides to marry her is going to commit adultery with her because of that.
I would think that once that man is a woman, that fornication is just happening, and the woman is going to be loose from it. But if her husband leaves her, she ought to wait until he does something. Otherwise, she should seek reconciliation. And if I have a friend that's going after a woman that's been divorced, she's got to stay away.
Mm-hmm.
And if that woman were to remarry for her departure on the woman, then she would be committing adultery for the first time at that point in her marriage. So it's not like you're living in adultery after she would remarry.
So you would give her freedom if he remarries? And she is innocent.
Yes, as soon as he remarries, he just gets adultery. And remarry.
Mm-hmm.
And at that, the adultery is a part of the subset of fornication.
And I would agree with that in that, because what you're saying is now he has committed the crime that God said he couldn't, which gives viable reason for divorce. But does that eliminate the second part of that, that says that whosoever shall marry her that is divorced committeth adultery? Because she was obviously guilty of that.
We're going to see as being adultery, we're going to see in Corinthians 7 where it says the unbelieving husband, if he depart, she's not under bondage. So she's not under servitude for that, the law that's binding her to her husband, which you're in Romans 7, I saw it, you know.
Mm-hmm. So the woman better start praying for that guy to get married. Someone else have their hand up? Here, go ahead.
Just trying not to make too big of a discussion. When does a marriage
after he leaves initially for not the reason of adultery, but then he remarries and has a new marriage with somebody else. Now she's not married. So when did her marriage to him happen first? Was it before they were actually married when they first and
yeah, no, I understand what you're saying.
We didn't really come up with an answer, I don't think, other than...
No, and I think that, obviously, contractually, in the Bible times, contractually, there was a time, and we're going to be talking about that in a few moments under betrothal, because we know that with Joseph and Mary, they had to get a bill of divorcement just to... He had to put her away. They weren't married yet, but contractually, under law, they were under the betrothal. Obviously, I believe to be that in God's eyes, two becoming one is a sexual union. Whether that means, again, like you're saying, where's the line of marriage and where's the line in God's eyes? What is marriage in the government's eyes? What is marriage? So there's going to be a line there.
They're about the reverse of that, which is probably a pretty slim chance, but somebody goes through the social ceremony of getting married, but they never consummate it, and now we're kept separate, and the reason comes up for divorcement. Now, in the eyes of the government, they're married. Whether they get the divorce or not, are they considered married? And if they were to divorce, she found out whatever the situation is, that a biblical reason for divorce?
I don't believe it's considered a marriage that's not been consummated. Let me acknowledge it's never been consummated, it's not a marriage. So that's important in law, and that's another thing.
Okay. I don't know that we're gonna. Yeah. Well, for obviously, in God's eyes, I don't think the ceremony has that much weight to it. Obviously, but he does hold up the contract, at least in his eyes, in the illustrations given in New Testament, or even in the Old Testament, the betrothal and stuff. But obviously, the most important thing to God is the union. The two becoming one kind of draws that. There's going to be some questions. I don't think that you're going to have some great minds on both sides of this. I've got some books on my shelf that will take you in both directions. And some people are very, very, very strict to this letter of the law. And I don't know that you and I can be definitive on everything completely. We're going to have to figure that stuff out and live by a certain code. But I don't know that you and I are going to have the total answer on all the situations that are going to be brought up. I have to put some deep thought to that. I don't think it matters.
So is it still in the Old Testament? I know that the man here is in the New Testament, but even there on the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
But is it on the Old Testament?
Yes, it was based on Old Testament, reiterated by Christ in the New Testament. Yes.
So does that mean that those from the Old Testament that had more than one wife, that they had committed adultery and fornication?
Good question. And we're going to be touching on polygamy in just a little bit.
Well, what about the problem? I mean, he had 300 wives.
How can you get any dumber than that? Man of wisdom, huh? Yep. Well, God didn't lead him to do that.
No, but I mean, he allowed him to do it.
Yeah, but God's going to allow us to do whatever we want.
He will.
And we will do whatever we want. And God's not going to force anything on us. God, I guarantee you, because God's command in the Old Testament was, thou shalt not multiply wives unto thyself, a king. Solomon didn't add wives, he multiplied. And he broke the commandment completely. So I know that God was not on that one. David didn't multiply, but David added wives, yes. And I will agree that that was not the right thing either. And but Solomon is in a class of his own. Solomon is untouchable. All right, quickly, let's go to this, page number 101, the desertion of an unsaved spouse. And this was mentioned by Andy just a moment ago. And Paul gives a clear word on this, that if an unsaved spouse decides to leave, the saved spouse ought not to seek separation. But if the unsaved spouse decides to leave, God says you're not under bondage in such a situation. And he says, but to the rest I speak not I, not the Lord. If any brother hath a wife that believeth not, and she be pleased to dwell with him, let him not put her away. And the woman which hath a husband that believeth not, if he be pleased to dwell with her, let her not leave him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband, else were your children unclean, and now they are holy. But if the unbelieving depart, let him depart. A brother or a sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God hath called us to peace. And so, that is the second situation that we mentioned, the desertion, I didn't put that up there, of an unsaved spouse, the departing of an unsaved spouse. And number three was the death of a spouse. Now, I know that's obvious, but we're going to list them all. But Paul says it clearly, how that the law hath dominion over a man as long as he liveth. For the woman which hath an husband bound by law to her husband so long as he liveth. But if the husband be dead, she is loosed from the law of her husband. Now, I don't know if Paul was writing that because there were people holding widows to that or not. But Paul says clearly that when a spouse dies, that there is no such thing as adultery in the situation where that person remarries. And for many or for most, it's probably a good idea. Now, there were some other regulations on divorce, and here's the one example I want to give to you, that if one were to be married and divorce and remarry, you're not to return to the original. God says, no, that's not going to happen. And that's Deuteronomy chapter 24. He does not want that to happen, not returning to the original spouse. And I think that you know, there are some people that might think, well, in the situation we're in, we didn't realize what we did, it was wrong, we shouldn't have left each other, and we want to... Well, in God's eyes, He doesn't want that to happen. Verse number 4, her former husband, which sent her away, may not take her again to be his wife. After that, she is defiled, for it is abomination before the Lord. And thou shalt not cause the land to sin, which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance. And so there's something there for that. All right, let's take our break right there, and we will jump in at the betrothal. The betrothal, which is a weightier is weightier than engagement, was entered into with much ceremony. It usually took place a year before the marriage, at least in most situations. The two people were not separate, could not be separated except for a bill of divorcement. And we saw that, we've mentioned that already. the process was a covenant, an agreement that was binding by law. It was viewed as more than an engagement. It was contractually a marriage that was not consummated by the sexual union. And we mentioned already the illustration of Joseph and Mary and how that showed that to us. And there's a little bit of an explanation of that under number two from a commentator. But the betrothal was a very strong contract in the Bible times. Now, in regards to that today, obviously we don't... The engagement process is as close as you're going to get, but that's... The engagement really doesn't mean anything, especially contractually. So there are people, I do warn people who are engaged, though, that it does do something up here that more than it does anything on paper or on contract. But when people get engaged, they assume that they are one already, but they're not. And so I warn engaged couples, be careful, be aware of this new challenge that you're going to face, that obviously we're going to be married anyway, so why not? And but that is obviously not true. Even Joseph and Mary, who are by contract married in God's eyes under the law, they still never consummated, they still never touched prior to their wedding. And we know that to be true because Joseph was, it says so, number one, but number two, Joseph was shocked by her being pregnant and he was going to leave her, he was going to divorce her. Anyway, let's go on to letter C, the role of men in the home and in the culture. Men are to provide leadership to their family, their society, and their church. This role has come under serious attack, especially over the last 100 years, especially since the World War era when women were needed in the workplace, and that's when really the big push for women to work came into play. Because the men were overseas fighting, the women went into the factories and ran things and helped provide things. And it's one of those things where you probably, I don't know if I should turn this off for these comments or not, but you've probably done something where you thought it was going to be a short-term thing and it became a habit. Maybe your family decided you're going to try something and it just became a way of life. And that's pretty much what happened in the World War era, in which women were needed to work. And then I'm imagining the assumption was to work while the men were gone, and as soon as the men were back, they'll be back home again. But it became a way of life, and our culture will never go back to those days ever again, never retreat to that. But it only gets worse. I was just printed off this article today. It's called Man Overboard, a Washington Post, so want to get some good information. But this is how it starts. I have a new theory about what's behind everything that's wrong with the Bush administration. Semicolon, manliness. So here's the problem. Here's why this administration is such a failure. Because of too much manliness. Okay? And of course, President Bush is a man's man. He uses a chainsaw by himself. Now here's a guy who could order anybody to go and clear out his property at his ranch. He could say to anybody at any time, go and take care of it. And no eyebrows would even be raised. They'd just do it. But not him. Cowboy boots go on. The work clothes go on. Chainsaw in hand, and he's a man's man. And but they say that's his weakness. Here's the thesis of a book. Manliness is the name of a book by Harvey Mansfield. So there's a book called Manliness, who this person writing this article is going to refute the premise of that book. Mansfield's thesis, the man who wrote the book, is that manliness, which he sums up as, quote, confidence in the face of risk, is a misunderstood and unappreciated attribute. Now, the person writing the article is going to disagree with that. They disagree that it's unappreciated and misunderstood. Manliness, he writes in this book, seeks and welcomes drama and prefers times of war, conflict, and risk. It entails assertiveness, even stubbornness, and craves power and action. It explains why men naturally incline to assert that, quote, our policy, our party, our regime is superior, dominate in the political sphere. The problem of manliness is not that it does not exist. This is from the book. It does exist, but it is unemployed. So the man who writes this book says manliness is there, but it's not employed very much. In other words, men need to be men more often, is what the book is saying. The person writing the article is going to disagree with that. And here's what this person writing the article says. Well, excuse me, but I think it's just my opinion now. Maybe you disagree, and I'm sure we could work it out. Mansfield has it exactly backward. Manliness does exist. The problem is that it's overemployed. Nowhere more than this administration. Yes, sir?
Who wrote that article? Was it male or female?
What's her name?
Her name is Ruth. Now, and they bring up this point, which is interesting, because I was just listening to someone talking about this today. Bill Clinton's would-be successor in worrying about being manly. If I were him, I would have been too. Worried about this, was mocked for enlisting Naomi Wolf to help him emerge as an alpha male. Remember, he had hired a lady that helped him dress right. He was wearing all the earth tones at that time when he was trying to win. It really helped him. French-speaking John Kerry. That's what it's written, okay? Had to give up windsurfing and don hunting gear to prove he was a man. And so you go down. Didn't work for him either. All right. Now here's how this thing closes. I'm not going to read all of this because they obviously take shots at the administration in many different ways. But Manfield writes that he wants to, quote, convince skeptical readers, above all educated women, that irrational manliness deserves to be endorsed by reason. In other words, men, put on your cowboy boots and be a man. Okay? That's what the book is saying. Now here's the response again. Sorry, professor, you lose. What this country could use is a little less manliness. A little more of what you would describe as womanly qualities. Restraint. Since when is restraint womanly? Introspection. Maybe a little more of a point. A desire for consensus. When did consensus ever keep you out of trouble? Maybe even a touch of self-doubt. So in other words, this administration is living all of those things. Now, I bring this up to point to you that our country is becoming but is gender sensitive. And it all started back, again, World War times, in which the women were involved and started taking on the role of leader in the home. And it hasn't changed. Our country never recovered from that. And men are slowly now becoming, instead of the breadwinner, they're staying at home and taking care of the family while the wife is out working. You know what? There are situations where that is okay. There are exceptions to that, but that shouldn't be the rule. The men are supposed to be leaders. Let's hit some of these points here. Number one, men are to lead. They are the head, as Christ is the head of the church. The leadership is loving and includes spiritual, emotional, financial aspects in decision making. And so these things are important as a man leading. The men are supposed to lead spiritually. Is there any more area of inadequacy than that in men today? Churches, if you talk to people who travel in churches, you go and you talk to the people who travel with New Yorkers. You talk to Tom Stiles and ask him what it's like in the churches across New York. He will tell you that it is dominantly female. Churches today lack male leadership. And men are to lead. Number two, men are to love. That's the feminine side, right? Uh-huh. But God says it this way, to destroy all that, we are to love as Christ loved the church. How is that? Sacrificially. Throw yourself in front of the truck. Be willing to lay your life down for the person that you love, for your wife. So the selfless love for his wife will be the foundation of reciprocating love and respect. And by the way, this is not only an issue, this gender-sensitive thing is not only an issue in the relationships and marriage. I also printed these off just as a good fun time. How the new modern versions are becoming gender-sensitive. So if you want to have a gender-sensitive Bible, this is the important place to go. You can go to places like the TNIV. It zaps he over 1,090 times. It also takes out him over 1,600 times. It takes out his over 290 times. So the NIV translators justify their zapping over 3,000 masculine pronouns by claiming diverse and complex cultural forces. That's what's in the preface of the TNIV. And That's why they do that. But you will find many versions today doing that, trying to be careful of cultural issues. Number three, men are to provide. This provision is physical, emotional, and financial. Adam was first required to keep the garden. Then was given his helpmeet. It shows the importance of being proven and responsible before marrying. And I'll tell you this. Too many people jump into marriage too quickly. I really believe that men, and some of you who are young enough to hear this, you better be ready to provide for your family. Don't get married until you know you can provide for your family. I'm preaching from a void. I married as a missionary here in the United States. When my wife and I got married back in 1990, I was bringing home the bacon. About $400 a month. Not enough to do anything. I did do my laundry, and we had a little bit of groceries in the house, and that was it. Now, I'm not regretting a thing, but I am just saying, if counsel were to be given, you ought to prove. God had Adam take care of the garden, prove his ability to take care of himself and to be obedient to what God told him to do. And then he was given his helpmeet. And I think there's too many couples that are under too much strain and stress financially because they're not prepared for the wedding. They're not prepared beforehand. I know a young man in Michigan. He's been married now for probably maybe even 10 years. But when he got married, what would happen was he was engaged and the engagement broke off. He poured himself into his work. And he was a construction person. He built homes. And he worked longest hours he could work. He was working probably 5-6 days a week. And good Christian man. And when he got married, when he finally did get married, he took the first year off of work. He said, I'm going to just do what the Old Testament said. He took off a year. He not only took off a year, but he built his own house. He and his wife built their own house. He had enough money saved up so that he could take off a year, get to know his wife well, and not only do that, but build a home. Cash, by the way. Now, am I saying that's the best way to go? I don't know. I'm saying that he was wise in what he did, and I think that he was proving himself to his in-laws, the father who was saying, you're going to take care of my daughter, right? And that's the thing that goes through our minds. You better take care of my daughter. For those of you who are dads of girls, you know what I'm saying. You better take care of her. Well, he proved to his in-law, I'm going to take care of your daughter. I'm going to prove it by the way I've lived over the last year or two. And an interesting thing. By the way, this is the same guy who also took another Old Testament principle and started writing his own copy of the law, just as the kings were told to do. By hand, he started writing his own copy of the law. I just still haven't asked him how far he got or if he finished. I don't know. But he was taking that principle to heart for himself. All right, letter D, the role of women in home and culture. The women are to seek, are to be meek, quiet learners in the church. I preached this just 3 weeks ago. I want you to know I got phone calls almost immediately by the time I got home. I had an answering machine message for me waiting. Now, it was a misquote, I will tell you, from a young lady who was there, who, by the way, is not there enough to understand what preaching is all about. But the question did come, and are you saying that women can't do anything in the church? No, that's not what I said. I said there are parameters here. There's guidelines given. But anyway, the questions came flying just as quickly. But the women are to be quiet learners in the church. It's, again, one of those commandments. Some of us are probably afraid to preach or afraid to proclaim because there are some pretty strong women out there. But the Bible's pretty clear about this, that the wives are to be in subjection. 1 Peter 3:1, if any obey not the word, they may be without the word won by the conversation of the wise. That's not the one I'm looking for. Anyway, it's coming because it's down a little bit further in the 1 Timothy. Influence of women is limited in the church, but not eliminated. So the question came to me, are you saying that women can't give a testimony? I said, no, I didn't say that. I didn't say women can't give a testimony, but a woman cannot teach the men of the church. So if she's going to get up and give her testimony, let's keep it to a testimony. I get a little bit fearful when, and I'm not saying this is preaching, but I get a little bit fearful when a lady walks up there with her Bible and opens it up. That's starting to tread on thin ice. It's getting close. And I said, well, I'm just going to read this verse. Okay, read it, but don't start illuminating. Okay? And it's okay in the setting of the women. And I told this lady that, I said, well, understand, I'm not saying that, because, of course, word came back that you can't even do that in like in a ladies' retreat. I said, I didn't say that. I said, you can do that in a ladies' retreat, as a matter of fact. That's a great place for the elder to teach the younger, but not in the mixed crowd. Not when it's, when the men are there. Can women teach in Sunday school class? Well, are they men in there or are they boys? There's a little bit of a difference there. So the influence of the women is limited in church but not eliminated. Their influence is best found in the home through childbearing. Oh boy. Barefoot in the kitchen. Here we go, right? And we're all men here, fortunately. But understand something, that God says the best place for influence for the woman is in the home. Raising children. Teaching. And you know what? They actually have more influence than you and I do. They have time and energy invested into those young children to duplicate in them, to disciple those children to be what we want them to be what God wants them to be. And they have a great influence. And we can think of some men through the years, and you think of some people even in the Bible where Paul said to Timothy, the same faith that was in thy mother Lois, thy grandmother Eunice, he said, same faith is in you. And he not, of course, you know Timothy's dad wasn't saved, but the greatest influence was the women in his life, and that can be true. If women would be willing to not get upset when we start saying that kind of thing, they will have more influence than you and I will. And so we also listed Proverbs 14:1 and 31:27. Number three, the wife is to be a helpmeet for the husband. This means she is a support to him in making him a success at what he does. You know what? There is no shame in that. As a matter of fact, in any situation where you are a subordinate, that is your primary task. Even if your boss is not saved, you are to make them successful. My job is to make Pastor Grace look good. I have to do a good job so that he can say, you know what? I fully trust what Vinny does. I want him to be able to say that. And so my job is to make him look good. I don't want him to have phone calls saying, well, you know, this happened and this happened and this happened. It was bad stuff that comes back on me. I don't want that. And so my task is to make him successful. Is there any shame in that? Absolutely not. Everyone's a subordinate somewhere. And the wife and the husband become a reciprocating team of support and love if this is done under God's leadership. And so it's a helpmeet. Proverbs 31 gives a couple of these things. She exhibits moral and commercial integrity and competence. She manages well her household and is adept in finances to care for her family. She is hospitable and compassionate not only to her family but also to others in need. She is a woman of wisdom. This is in regards to general concept as well as commercial issues, child rearing, and managing the home. The elder teaching the younger. We have lost that somewhere. And we need to come back to those roots, to that foundation. The younger wives, the younger mothers ought to be able to come to those wives that are older, not only in the faith, but in years, and gain wisdom. What about child rearing? How do you take care of situations like that? What do you do when your child is giving an attitude? They've done what they're supposed to, but they've got an attitude. What do you do when kids do this? What do you do? And there ought to be a wealth of wisdom there. And it ought to be shared. And then the last thing, she's industrious and motivated. In other words, she's not sleeping until noon. She's actually doing something. And so those are some of the issues with men and women under this. Obviously, there's a whole lot more you get into, but we will not due to time. We have polygamy and polyandry. Obviously, polyandry is not something that's as big of an issue. A woman with multiple husbands, I think that that's very rare, as a matter of fact. But polygamy is not really an accepted thing in our culture, but it is still, in some situations and in some religions, still accepted. At a quick glance of the Bible, it would seem that having more than one wife was expected. It would be more accurate to say that it was tolerated rather than promoted. Many would cite Solomon, David, and Abraham as examples to support polygamy. Even in these exceptions, this was obviously not God's plan for mankind. From the very beginning, it was said, "Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, singular, and they shall be one singular flesh." Both of the people are mentioned in the singular. This was repeated in the New Testament, Ephesians 5:31. Paul stated it in the singular by saying, "Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband." Polygamy was also forbidden to church leaders, 1 Timothy 3:2. I would say to you there's a pattern there. And God is looking for that to be one. And Solomon and the examples and the anguish that they had, the anguish they went through. You think of Jacob and the failures that he went through because of those issues. Obviously, that is not what God is looking for. So just in a short setting, just to say, polygamy was not the norm, or it wasn't a command. It wasn't even permitted necessarily by God. It wasn't something that he was promoting, but he allowed it. He tolerated it. Down under F, sexual crimes. And here's a quote that I want to take note of. This comes from Rush Dooney. He and this is quoting, making allusion to someone else. He says, "Sex is the cause of nearly all crime, the dominant force that drives nearly all criminals." And our two police officers would probably be able to tell us whether or not this is true in the cases they see. After 35 years of correctional experience as warden of San Quentin Prison, a member of the California Adult Authority and executive director of San Francisco Council of Alcoholism, "I'm convinced," this is Rush Dooney quoting someone, "I'm convinced that it is a rare crime that can't be traced to a sexual inadequacy of some sort. Criminals are plagued and puzzled and upset by sexual tension, doubts, fantasies, anxieties, and hungers. In my opinion, 90% of the men in our nation's prisons are there because they couldn't come to grips with this problem, the problem of the sexual nature." And it has to, and you know this to be true, guys. It is becoming only worse. We live in a culture that is saturated everywhere we turn. It does not matter. My wife just called up Family Fun Magazine. So this magazine comes with great ideas for you and your family, some fun things to do, wholesome book, and advertisement for Fruit of the Loom. Yeah, it's not only a lady laying in her bra and panties on a bed, but she's like with a smile on her face doing something with her sheets. I mean, this is family fun. I'm glad I don't have boys at this point that have to fight through this culture. But she ended up calling up and complaining to them, letting them know that it's inappropriate for Family Fun Magazine. You know, put it in some other magazine, but why that one? And but our culture is saturated with it, and men are only getting worse. And it's a learned trend. Some of the sexual crimes listed under here include incest. And we don't need to go through all of these because of time. We also have rape, as mentioned. Last week we talked about the lady being raped in an open field. If she were to have cried out, she would have been not held guilty in this case. But if she didn't cry out, she would have been taken as just as guilty as the man, and she would have been killed. But there's some information there in regards to biblical law in the case of rape. We also mentioned homosexuality. the sin of that. Leviticus 18, very clearly, thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind. I think that's pretty clear what it's saying, wouldn't you say? It is abomination. And repeated Leviticus 20, 13. Bestiality, we kind of mentioned that last week as the death penalty was enacted in this. But we don't need to get into that now. Transvestites, this sin is not new in our culture, but our culture has done a great job at blurring the lines of right and wrong. There is more at stake with the sin than a man merely swapping clothes. We used to laugh at that because on MASH, the guy used to, what was his name? Clinger. You know, he used to wear a dress. And why did he do that? He did it to get out of the military. But that really is the concept of what is going on. But this is a swapping of roles. And I'm disgusted at this, that in high schools we've now allowed girls to be on wrestling teams and wrestle the boys. And, you know, I don't know what counsel I would give to a young man. Whether I would say destroy her or whether I would say don't touch her. I don't know which one yet, but I'm telling you, just this year, and it's happening more and more, the guy lost to a girl. I don't think I can go back to school. I'd say you win at all costs, young man, if you're going to go into that ring. North Star, I hope so. Yeah.
Some of them might
beat
some.
Well, I would, yeah. Anyway, I didn't wrestle because of the outfit, period. Okay, I wasn't going to wear one of those things, but that's enough of that. Anyway, so we have this issue of transvestites in Deuteronomy 22. The woman shall not wear that which pertaineth unto a man, neither shall a man put on a woman's garment. For all that do so are abomination unto the Lord thy God. It's confusion. And let's go move on to top of page 108, the fixture of the law. How did the law still affects us today? Number one, adultery is symbolic of God's people being unfaithful to Him. And so there is a such thing as we would call spiritual adultery. Letter B, the sin of adultery is not just a sin of commission, but it's also a sin of the heart. And you and I, as men, have to plan how we're going to defeat this thing. And I've listed some obvious things in here. And to be very practical on this, obviously we have to be careful of our thoughts. But more importantly than that, number two, be careful of what you watch and listen to, because those are going to directly affect our thoughts. You and I have to have a plan. We have to have a battle plan. We have to be ready because it's coming. You cannot just say, I'll wing it when it comes, because you're not going to make it. You're going to be another casualty in this battle. I've already told you about one of my friends in Michigan who was the state trooper, and he had his plan, and he went running screaming out of the locker room when they tried to show him a centerfold. And he screamed, went running out, and they thought he was crazy, but he said this is his statement when he got to the top of the steps, and his head officer came out, whoever it was. He said, "Look, listen, they tried to show me pornography." He said, "I've been there, and I'm not going back." And he said from that day, he won the victory. And he doesn't struggle with it anymore. Not that he's not a man, but I'm saying he doesn't struggle with it in that the battles that he used to face, where the turmoil in his heart was a constant thing, he says, that's not there anymore. He finally won his victory. Be careful of what you listen to and who you listen to. I've got the verses mentioned there. Proverbs 7:21. It says, "Of that one with her much fair speech, she caused him to yield." The same thing happened to Samson, Judges 16. Same thing happened to Joseph in Genesis 39, where she spoke to him day by day, like that Chinese water torture, constantly dripping over time. If we're not careful, we'll give in. We talk about the Word of God permeating our life. The Bible is very clear. It says, "Flee youthful lust." I don't think that's a spiritual analogy. There are probably times when you and I need to get out of a place, take off, and run. And that was why my friend Tom did that, because he was taken flee youthful lust literally. And so those are some of the things, the practical things that we need to consider. If we're going to survive this thing, this culture that we live in, we're going to have to take action. Now, New Testament church is not to overlook the sin of adultery. Grace is not a justification, and this is not what it means to not judge one another, as some would say. We are to judge sinful situations, and Paul did that in his first book to the Corinthians. And I want to just mention these points to us because we don't like conflict, and we don't like confrontation. And whenever it comes to a situation, we like to go to someone else, hey, why don't you talk to them? They got a problem. And we all talk big talk until we're the ones that have to go and say something to someone. And it's very rare that someone actually doesn't mind confrontation. And but the church cannot overlook this. And here's what happens in 1 Corinthians 5, some of the steps. The church has to take the sexual sin seriously. And that's number one. We have to take it seriously. Do not overlook the sin due to the people involved or the fear of getting involved. In other words, confrontation. So we have to take this serious. And Paul was very upset in verses 1 through 3 in regards to the way they had handled this. Paul said, hey, I'm not there, but I'm giving you my judgment right now. This is what you need to do. The thing he told them to do, number one, is to deliver the person unto Satan for the destruction of the flesh. Now, obviously, there's controversy over what this means. Let me explain to you what Rush Dooney says. I have it in the notes. He says, thus, the death penalty is clearly God's law for incest and or adultery. So he's going to say this. He's going to say this is pointing to the death penalty. But his explanation, before you jump, he says, the church, however, cannot execute a man. The death penalty does not belong to the church. The church, however, must in effect pronounce the death penalty by delivering the man to Satan, i.e., the providential protection of God is withdrawn so that the man might be humbled and redeemed. So he is going to allude to the death penalty. Obviously, not literally, because you and I as the church don't have the right to that, but we can break or excommunicate someone so that they will learn the lesson. Now, again, this is not always the most popular thing, but I'm afraid that in our culture, in our churches in America today, we have gone so far to the opposite extreme that fornication and adultery is prominent in the churches and no one's doing anything. Everyone's looking the other way. Oh, someone else will take care of it. Someone else will deal with it. The next thing that he tells them in the next chapter as he continues to deal with this is that to purge the church, thus clearing out the unrepentant, guilty party. And so he tells them to do that, 1 Corinthians 5, 6 and following. And so Paul is very serious about this, and we need to be, and we need to be willing to deal with these sins that are in the church. We cannot let them just go on. It has to be dealt with. It has to be dealt with properly. I believe that there's a right way, obviously, of doing it. We have to go to Matthew 18 and follow some procedure. But for us just to ignore it or just to let it go on, it does nothing but hurt us and our church. And I know this. I don't want my children to have to grow up in a church where adultery is prominent. It destroys the whole concept of who God is and the picture of Christ in the church. Yes, sir?
It's just a question.